The name Sarah Fuller. Anybody this morning? Sarah Fuller. And this is a name that came up yesterday or Friday. I don't know when it was. I'm losing track of the days. But this young lady from one of the colleges in our country, in the country of ours, basically has made history by being the first female to play on a Power 5 college football game. So COVID, what has done, as you guys know, has limited the number of players and availability to play the game. So this young lady is the goalie for the women's soccer team. And they use her in the actual football game. Was it yesterday or Friday? It was yesterday. Yeah, my family is gone. My wife is gone and my kids are gone from the house. So when I'm by myself, I lose track of time and everything in my life. I don't function the same. But when I think of COVID-19, and again, this morning, many of you are gracious enough to connect with us via the internet, and many of you guys are here this morning, so thank you. But COVID has changed many, many things. One of the things that COVID has done, and this is exactly where we're going for the next few minutes, COVID has exposed what we may call the bottom lines of life. And having this young lady played yesterday was exactly because the bottom line, this is going to be a game. You know, organizations, industries, I mean, you think about elections. I mean, it has been, besides the controversial issues and the divisiveness and polarization of whatever is going on politically, it was and it has been a challenge just to have an election this year. But the bottom line is that we needed to have a president. We need to elect a president. So again, for the world of sports, my understanding, there has been some postponing of games within professional sports. The NBA, within the last few months, they created a bubble. They went and created their own little thing so they can get to the bottom line of the industry, you know, and obviously that's the result of COVID. The question is, and this is where we're going for the next few minutes, what do you think is the bottom line when it comes to Christianity? What's the non-negotiable? And here's what I'm coming, and this is why I'm emphasizing this on the last Sunday of November, moving into December, which is hard to believe, but we are almost at the end of the year. It's exactly that for us, ultimately, I am of the mindset, and again, this is completely prejudice and a little bit of a just personal biases on this thing, is that we have negotiated what we call the non-negotiables in Christianity. And let me explain what I mean by that. So give me a little room to explain myself, and then we'll come back. And obviously, my goal is not for you to agree with me. My goal is that you go and search the scriptures. So whatever I present to you, you're going to make sure you're responsible to make sure that I'm speaking the Bible, right? Not just my thoughts of the Bible. So here's what I mean by that. I think for the church, the bottom line, the non-negotiable, is that we find Christianity, we find salvation, we find God, not on our experiences, but on the tangible, objective reality of the person of Jesus Christ. We are the generation that tragically, I think we have negotiated the bottom line because we are the generation, for whatever reason, whether it's the inheritance of previous generations just passing on to us, whether it was just organically and just came into because of our upbringing and, again, the transitions in life, maybe COVID, I don't know, whatever it may be, but many of us, we have believed, we have embraced that Christianity or God is about what I feel. It's about my experience, about my testimony. It's what happened when I was back in, or what I'm feeling today, or what I hope to feel in the future. We call that the subjective. I don't believe the Bible opposes the subjective. I don't believe the Bible opposes your experiences and your, you know, again, testimonies and what happened when you went through whatever you went through. But that's not what the gospel is. The gospel for us is literally the objective reality. That 2,000 years ago, a brand new baby boy was born, in spite of what people felt or thought, or the preconceived ideas of what they had in their minds when it comes to this concept of Messiah. I'm thinking of Peter making the confession of Matthew chapter 16, when he says that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. He made an objective, non-negotiable, bottom line, you are the Christ. And then you go into the conversation and Jesus feels or thinks or sees the need to explain Peter's affirmation that he is Messiah, he is the Son of the living God. And tragically, and I said tragically, sarcastically, but tragically, Jesus explains that coming from the historical understanding that Messiah implied suffering, that Messiah implied eventually to be taken captive and punished, that Messiah or Messiahship has to do with eventually being killed and placed on a gravesite. So the disciples don't like the definition of Jesus of Messiah. Because they knew that if you're Messiah and you have to die, more than likely, we're going to have to die. And we don't like that idea. This is why Peter, in the very same passage, speaks and says, never. I will never allow that to happen. And Jesus replies, get behind me, Satan. What's the point? That Peter moved from a tangible, objective reality that Jesus is Messiah to what he thought and felt about the definition of Messiah. And once the definition did not meet, you know, the preconceived idea, then we go back to square one, where Peter now is presented exactly as Satan himself. Would it be possible that as a generation we have made the same mistake? Would it be possible that COVID, and I said COVID, but just tragedy, challenges, difficulties, would it be possible that we have based our Christianity, our relationship with God, based on our preconceived ideas, our previous experiences, what we feel today? We don't feel it the way we felt it. Now, this is important to us to convey on a day like this, because the book of Romans, and that's where we are, Paul is going to invest 11 chapters, the first 11, chapter 1 through 11, to explain the objectivity of the gospel. And by the way, what he does on 11 chapters, he's going to also explain what the gospel is not. And what the gospel is not, here's the point, what the gospel is not what the church is. See, the church is the result of the gospel. The church is not the gospel. What the gospel is basically 11 chapters of in-depth explanation of the confusion that the church in Rome was having. So from chapters 12, which is where we are, 12 and following, is actually what we call the subjective. Now there's the experiential. This is what you do. This is how you behave. This is how you navigate racial reconciliation in the church in Rome. This is how you navigate to be under a government that is bullying you and oppressing you. This is how you navigate corrupt leadership in the church. This is how you navigate, and then goes on and on from 12 and following. So all that I'm trying to tell you this morning is that my goal, our goal, hopefully today, is that we come back to the bottom line of Christianity. Why? Because I'm here to, again, I'm just arguing my point. I'm trying to present my case. I think that we have negotiated that. Now, with that being said, if you were with us last week, I introduced this and I gave you kind of the challenge that we have, because in chapter 13, which is part of the, again, the behavior, the this is what it means of the 11 chapters, on chapter 13, he is instructed the church on how to deal with the reality of a government that, again, this is my understanding, that there is not such a thing as a Christian government. I think there is governments who process and do life through the worldview of the Bible. I'm going to say that again. There is not such a thing as Christian countries. There is not such a thing as Christian families. I think what it is, there are families who process life through the lenses of the gospel. What he's telling us here is that he's simply bringing the conversation that regardless of who the government is, see, in spite of what is going on with the government, there is only governments that they process life. You know, they create policies and they do the structure of societies through the lenses of the gospel. What is the gospel? I'm going to say this again. The gospel is not the fact that they were Jews. The gospel is not the fact that they were Gentiles or non-Jewish. The gospel is not that they came from Greek background or Roman background or barbarian background or whatever you and I come from. That's not the gospel. The gospel is the 11 chapters of the book of Romans. And based on that entire chunk of information, which is a lot, and it's so just deep and profound on this, he comes and says, this is what you do. This is what you do. And again, this is so difficult to do for us because we typically base these experiences of the submission of dealing with governmental officials, ladies dealing with a husband, singles dealing with whatever we're going through life, we typically put this in the context of what we feel and how we see it and how we grew up. What is my perspective? What is my understanding? I don't believe the Bible disagrees or opposes what you feel. But I'm going to say this again. God only endorses what Jesus felt, not what we feel. God only endorses what Jesus said, not what I say about Jesus. What I say about Jesus is important, and everybody has an opinion. So we all are theologians. Everybody has an opinion of who God is, even if you don't believe that there is a God. But here's the point. The point of the story is that he's asking us, he's helping us to navigate based on the non-negotiable of what the gospel is, which is, I'm going to say this again, is based on the objective reality of 11 chapters. That gospel now translates into the subjective. And in this case, to me, this kind of has a little bit of subjectivity because look at the situation when you have a government authorities that every single one of us, no exception, every one of us, if we are navigating life through the lenses of the gospel. See, that's the implication. The implication is the 11 chapters prior. If you have never given your life to Jesus, if you are sitting in this place watching through this beautiful venues of internet and you are still thinking that you are saved because of what you felt, if you're thinking that you're safe because of what you believe, I don't believe those things are necessarily wrong, but I'm telling you, your salvation, especially when you are illustrating this to government officials, government systems, which you and I know, government systems change. They're supposed to change. Life changes. You change. I change. Everybody changes. Does that make sense? What do you do when life is chaotic and changing and the change is not favorable and the change is not perceived as something that is helping us? What do? You base your life in the unchangeable, in the unmovable, in the uncompromisable experience, not of subjectivity, but objectivity, which is the first 11 chapters of the book of Romans. Now, here's what I want you to, again, just if you were not with us last week, you can go back and watch online what we said about this whole entire deal, because to me, man, this is so crazy today. I don't know if you agree with me on this. This is so hard to do. This is almost impossible to do. To see the sovereignty of God in the context of government systems that you and I agree that they're not working. They're not working. They are not working. And the reason why they're not working is simply, here's the reason, because we do not believe that there is such a thing as a Christian government. We believe that there are governments that they process, that they create policies through the lenses of the first 11 chapters of Romans. I don't know if that makes any sense. Okay, so here we go. So the question is, what do you do with this? Well, again, as long as we continue to be the generation, as long as we continue to be the generation that we negotiate the bottom line, I just explained that, right? As long as we continue, and by bottom line meaning shifting, switching around, again, the objectivity versus the subjectivity of the gospel, as long as we continue to do that, we're going to struggle to process all of this through the lenses of the gospel. The Bible is not calling us to be under a government that embraces the gospel. The Bible is calling us to simply navigate the brokenness of life through the lenses that there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. So here's what I'm trying to tell you. As long as we continue to be confused and negotiate the non-negotiables, we're going to continue to have Christians or Christianity without a church. This is a contradiction of term. This goes against the nature of Jesus Christ. I'm going to say this again. Because Romans, the book of Romans, the church in Rome is dysfunctional. The church in Rome is not the ideal church, it's the real church. Anybody tracking what I'm saying? I'm going to say that again. See, we're called, the objectivity of the gospel invites us, brings us into the subjectivity of what we feel and how we are treated and the relationships and how we feel about the church. And again, I'm not against your feelings, but once I'm going to say this again. See, as long as we continue to navigate church through the subjectivity of what you think and how I feel about church, we're going to continue to struggle to navigate this. Is anybody following what I'm saying? In other words, if we're the generation that tragically our governments are not asking for separation from church and state, but our governments are asking for separation from the government and God, the tragedy is not when this happens. The tragedy is when these people don't know what to do when this happens. All right, one more time. The tragedy, and it's tragic when you have a system, whether it's your family, whether it's your job, whether it's economics, whether it's whatever other system in life, divorces and detaches from God. That's tragic. But I think why Paul is writing to the Roman church, the church in Rome, is because although this was the reality, Paul sees that the issue is that the church does not know what to do with this reality. Now, this is why in chapter 12, he embraces with this transition of the objective message of the gospel, 11 chapters, what the gospel is, what the gospel is not. And again, we don't have the time to go through 11 chapters, obviously. I'm focusing on the 12th chapter of the 12 and following. He says, I urge you, and the you is communal. It's a communal thing. It's not you as an individual, but it's a plural you, brothers and sisters. And this is where the urgency, this is where the calling comes. It comes in view of God's mercy. Now, he's going to get to chapter 13 eventually, and some of us, we have made the mistake to think that God's mercy is only experienced if the government embraces the worldview of the Bible. In other words, some of us, we think that God's mercy is if we can get a government that embraces God. See, that's not what the Bible is saying. What the Bible is saying, that in spite of the situation, in spite of the doctor's, you know, diagnosis, in spite of what happened at home and what happened when I was 17, what happened, in spite of those things, here's the bottom line. It is in view of the mercy of God. We spent, how many weeks? 9 weeks in the book of Amos. And the book of Amos was a book that explained and gave and presented this tangible reality, this very objective reality of the judgment of God. And if there was one principle that we emphasize every week, was the judgment of God, the justice of God is the result of the mercy of God. That's the principle that we nail and hammer and broad and continue to emphasize. So when he says, in view of God's mercy, he speaks of offering what he's going to do in the objective, I'm going to say that again, the objective reality of the mercy of God. I'm going to say this again. I don't know how to emphasize that. I just don't know. I'm asking the Lord to help me. I've been asking throughout this week. Help me to communicate this way. Most of us, we read God's mercy, and we base the mercy of God on how he makes me feel his mercy. In other words, when I'm going through the valley of the shadow and death, when things are not working out, when the damage is irreversible, I just don't feel the mercy of God. I may know conceptually that there is a God who is merciful, a God who is sovereign, but when it comes to his providence, in other words, I believe that God rules over everything, but his sovereignty sometimes looks very foreign because the world is upside down. And it seems that he's losing control of the world. Have you ever felt like that? Sometimes you are like, okay, I understand that he is the God who rules over everything, but in reality, I don't feel the mercy of God. I feel the judgment of God. This is why he spent 11 chapters, 11 long chapters to convey to us the non-negotiable, the tangible, the objective. So when you come to the subjective, when it comes to how you feel, maybe the mercy, or you may feel maybe the judgment of God, wherever you may find yourself, is not based on what you feel. So in this case, what he does, and this is just a quick example, he closes that 11th chapter. Watch this. The 11th chapter. He closes that section of the objective, the gospel, the non-negotiable, the bottom line, by saying this. Here are the mercies of God. Who has known the mind of the Lord? It's a rhetorical question. Who has known the mind of the Lord? In other words, who has the ability, who among us has the ability to question what God is doing in the context of whatever is going on in your life? And then he goes, or who has been his counselor? In other words, the implication, here's the implication, that if you and I, or the church in Rome, continue to base life through the subjective experience of what I think, my Jewish background, my Gentile Greek philosophy background, speaking of the church, whatever you come from, as long as you continue to do that, you're going to continue to think that you can search the mind of God. I'm going to continue to think that he needs to ask for my counsel. So if you think about it, as long as I continue to base my faith, my reality, my identity on the subjectivity of what I think, how I feel, how things are moving, what they said I was, or who I think I am, you're asking for trouble because you're placing yourself in God's place. Now he says on verse, this is the mercy of God. Who has ever given to God that God should repay? In other words, why do you keep perpetuating a mindset, a lifestyle of entitlement, and you simply get some Bible verses to affirm what you have always believed. Because before Jesus, you were entitled. Now with Jesus, Church of Rome, in Rome, you continue to be, it's like everybody owes you, it's your rights, it's because you're a citizen, it's because you're a member, it's all this entitlement. And he basically says, who has given to the Lord that God should repay him? And then here's my favorite one. Watch this. For from the Lord, the one that his mind and his ways are higher than our minds, our thoughts, and our ways, the God who owes absolutely nothing to anybody. He owes nothing to none of us. It's the one that from him and through the same God and for the same God that are all things. So what we discovered last week is that Jesus, through his birth, Christmas, is nothing else but Jesus brings and merges the sacred and the mundane, the holy and the pagan. I don't know if my language, my vocabulary is helping today. But Jesus comes and blesses what is not supposed to be blessable. How do I know this? Again, I gave you examples last week. Who did the angels show up to? The shepherds. I told you they were at the bottom of this societal, you know, kind of a diagram or hierarchy. What does he do? Speaking of how he merges things, I mean, he's born out of a virgin in a manger, and then the way he deals with his ministry, the way he goes about life. All that I'm trying to tell you is that look at the sovereignty of God. It's for him, from him, and through him, and for him are all things. Will that include the tragedy and the depth and the sorrow and the grief that you and I may experience in this life? Look at me. Yes. Yes, he does. He's a big boy. He can handle your craziness and my brokenness. I don't know if that makes sense. Now, here's the thing. The suggestion, the invitation is that we get these principles. This is the end of 11 before you get into the what does that mean and what do I do now that I'm going through whatever I'm going through. Well, what you and I are called to, this is the mercy of God that he did not have to. He did not have to show us that from him and through him and for him are all. He didn't have to do those, but he chose to reveal that. This is why Paul invests 11 chapters to convey this, that at the end, you know, bringing, reminding, reestablishing the bigness of God. It's not an indictment. It's not a loophole for you to simply say, well, if he is who he says he is, he should change X, Y, and Z in my life. No. See, the beauty, and this is the mercy of God. Remember, he's saying, brothers and sisters, I urge you, based on the mercies of God, what's the mercy of God? That in spite of what's happening, in spite of the subjectivity of life, meaning what you feel, what you think, what your experience was, how your mama raised you, and what the previous pastor said. In spite of those things, here's the thing. To him, that's the mercy of God. That at the end, you get to glorify God. That he didn't ever promise to change the circumstances. He promised to give you the experience, the power, the might, the freedom to worship him in spite of the circumstances. He never promised that he was going to change the scenario for you. He is not speaking to the church in Rome and saying, guys, if you get your act together, your theology together, your lifestyle together, if you fix your relationships, I promise you I'll change the government for you. I promise you I'll give you cohesiveness instead of divisiveness in the church. Never promised that. What he's doing is he's promising that in spite of everything, all things are from him. All things literally are coming through him. And every single thing is for him. That's why it's that we are able to bring glory to him forever and ever. Well, those are the mercies of God, and this is why once we understand that, then we are able to offer our bodies. Again, the holistic view of giving ourselves to the Lord, not because of what he is going to do, but because what he has done. Not because of what is it that I'm experiencing, but it's because of who he is. So I offer my bodies as a living sacrifice, which implies, here is how he wants, and by the way, he's speaking into a generation that they had this mindset that you can divide or divorce what you believe and what you do, your theology and your doctrine from your lifestyle. So he's bringing this fullness, this integration, this holistic view that obviously when he implies the bodies, is implying that your body, you know, what you do with your body, how you treat your body, who do you think you are, cannot continue to be based on the subjectivity of what you feel or what you think or what you were told or what your profile on social media says. It's based on the reality that in spite of your brokenness, in spite of how difficult and how much suffering your body is going through, maybe it is your soul, maybe it is your spirit, maybe mentally you're struggling with ups and downs, whatever you may find yourself, he's saying, based on the mercy of God that I just described to you, 11 chapters of the mercy of God that gives you this reality check, this tangible experience of the person of Jesus, not of the church, but of Jesus, is that now you offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, which implies, here's a living sacrifice, is that the word holy is not the absence of sin. The word holy is that your bodies, your mind, your spirit, your intellect, everything within you has been set apart for him. So whatever you do it for him. Why? Once again, because we understand that everything is from him, everything is through him, and everything is... I'm not implying that he approves everything that happens to us. Please do not hear me say this. I'm not implying that he approves everything that the church in Rome is going through. He did not approve the abuse of the government. He did not approve the corruption of the leadership in the church. He did not approve the bullying and the human trafficking. He did not approve, but he has reminded us that in the context of the brokenness and the dysfunctionality and the self-inflicted pain that the church continues to bring into herself, he says, you have the ability that in your brokenness, maybe in the scars that you have from previous experiences, from whatever in the past, you are able to set apart your body for him. You are able to find yourself being pleasing to the Lord. And at the end, this is where you can understand and you will be reminded that you were created for truthfulness, that you were not created for falsehood. And that this is a time that you understand that this is what brings proper worship. So Paul closes by saying, stop conforming to the patterns of this world. What's the conforming? I'm going to say this again. The conforming of the pattern of this world is when the church continues. I want you to listen to this. Again, if you were doing something else, here's my punchline. This is what I'm taking home today. The message of Paul is stop trying to see chapters 12 through 16 of Romans, which is the subjective, this is what we do, this is what we pull ourselves together, this is what I do now that she is gone, this is what I do now that I lost my job, 12 through that. We're called to do that based on an objective reality of 11 chapters. See, the patterns of this world says you need to find a religion that allows you to feel good. You need to find a God that you can manipulate. You need to pray whenever you can. You commit whenever you can. Anybody following what I'm saying? See, what he's describing is literally saying, you got to stop this nonsense. I gave you 11 chapters of the objectivity of Old Testament reality through the person of Jesus, brought the conversation to the point that now we are in the subjective situation. We are into the tangible, into what we may call the actual imperatives, the obedience. So you need to stop that nonsense. And here's how you do it. You do it by the transformation of what you think. This is why. And again, this is going to sound like a commercial. This is why we must, especially men and women, but men, because women, you keep on choosing these men, right? So, and I got two daughters, so I'm speaking to the choir. I'm a fellow struggler. Look at me for a second. As long as we continue to choose, ladies, men who are not under the teaching of other men, this is why church is not negotiable, because my tendency is to create my own version of the gospel. Anybody tracking what I'm saying? My tendency as a man and a woman, but as a man, is this concept of autonomy that I decide who God is. I relate to God the way I want. No, look at me for a second. This is exactly what he's writing. This is not working. It's not working. It has never worked. And it's not going to work, because the bottom line is that the transformation begins by the renewing of your mind. And only then, this renewing of the mind is not the improvement of your mind. It's not going like an iPhone from iPhone 6 to iPhone, 12 now? Whatever we're on the iPhones. See, it's not the improvement with more gadgets and more, you know, features. Literally, this is the mind of somebody else's mind. The mind of, look at me, the mind of 11 chapters. The gospel, Jesus' mind. Tracking? This is not about just you hitting rock bottom and saying, oops, mom, forgive me. Speaking to the wife, speaking to the church and asking for forgiveness. This is not about, you know, putting the pieces back together. This is about the mind of Jesus being imputed, transferred, given, and accredited to your mind and my mind. And then you will be able to test and to approve what God's will is. What's the will of God? The will of God is Jesus. The will of God is the 11 chapters of Romans. Is that clear? Is that a simple message? Listen to it again. See, the will of God is not chapters 12 through 16. It is the will of God based on the objective message that had nothing to do with the church. See, the first 11 chapters had nothing to do with the church. Nothing. Because what we said as a definition, the gospel is what God has done without my help. That's the gospel. The gospel is simply what God has done out of his love and mercy for his church. This is why he simply comes and says, for though the grace given to me, I say to everyone, once again, this grace is not speaking of the road to Damascus in a sense of salvation experience. Salvation is chapters 1 through 11, right? I'll say that again. Salvation is chapters 1 through 11. Salvation is not what happened to him. See, what happened to him on Acts chapter 9, the road to Damascus, speaking of Saul becoming Paul, see, that experience is what happened out of salvation. In other words, what we're talking about with the grace that has been given to him is literally the purpose of why Acts chapter 9 exists. So I'm going to say this one more time. I wish I had another hour to preach to you, but we're going to have to come back next Sunday. But listen to me for a second. Listen. I told you from the beginning that the issue for the church, the non-negotiable, the bottom line, is that we got to stop this nonsense of thinking that Christianity is the subjective. And again, I'm going to sound a little critical, but I'm just going to say it. The lyrics of the hymn, you know, you ask me how I know he lives within my heart. Anybody? Come on, Baptist. Yeah, the hymn. I'm not against that hymn. I'm not against hymns, but listen to the words. It's about your experience in your heart, right? Now, I'm not against your experience, as long as your experience is based on 11 chapters of the book of, in other words, your experience of knowing in your heart that he lives has to be based on what Jesus experienced, not on your experience by itself. Don't idolize what happened to you. Don't worship. See, Paul is bringing this conversation, say, okay, it is through the grace given to me that this experience of Acts chapter 9, my conversion, watch this, please, my conversion, what happened to me in Acts chapter 9, watch this, it happened because of the sovereignty of God, because of chapters 1 through 11, the God that sets and defines the purpose of redemption, and in chapter 9 of the book of Acts, I was simply invited to join the reason of this election, the reason of this redemption. Watch this. When he speaks of the grace given, it's simply that grace is not just what happened to you. That's salvation. Salvation is what happened to you. Grace is also that the same God defines why it happened to you. The purpose of that salvation. Apparently, the church in Rome, they were confused not about salvation. They were confused about why they were saved. Why are we saved? What's the purpose of this salvation? Now, look at me. If we're confused about the purpose of salvation, we're going to be confused about the purpose of marriage, the purpose of identity, the purpose of money, the purpose of struggles, the purpose of the government, the purpose of sexuality. Anybody tracking what am I saying? We're in trouble because we have negotiated the non-negotiable. So Paul says, here is the grace given to me that the God of the Bible not only saved me, but he also dictated, established why I am saved. And what is it that you're saved for, Paul? Well, he's saved. He says he gave it to me to say to everyone. See, the bottom line is this, is that if you are a follower of Jesus, you were saved for the health of the church. And as long as we continue to educate, to disciple our children, that salvation is what you feel, is how you feel, is what you think. It's what happened to you. See, the church is going to continue to be, what's the opposite of health? Unhealthy. As long as you make salvation chapter 12 through 16 in Romans, see 12 through 16, I'm going to say it again, 12 through 16 is simply what happens once you're saved. It is the result of being saved. See, salvation is what happened on chapters 1 through 11. And this is why he says, I want for everyone to understand, because if the church is going to be healthy, it's going to require not a new pastor, not better preaching, not better Sunday school classes. What's it going to require? It's going to require... Oh, come on. If the church is going to be healthy, if you're going to be a healthy Christian, you need everyone. See, people who do life, Christians, without the church, they, instead of grace given, they think that God owes them salvation because I don't have any tattoos because I was a virgin when I got married. Any track, again, I'm not, I know I just lost you with the tattoos. Look at me for a second. It's not about what you do. It's not chapters 12 through 16. The grace of God is chapters 1 through 11 that Paul introduces this grace by speaking of depravity. Isn't that crazy? Grace in the context of depravity? That's exactly what we need. We need the diagnosis, the reality that we are not sinners because we sin. It's that our sin is simply the result that we are sinners. So this is why he says, I want you to understand that this is for everyone among you not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think. But instead, you need to think so as to have sound judgment as God. See, here's what's happened in the church. The church was driven by badges, by curriculum, by entitlement, by what I know and how long I've been here, by knowledge, by experiences. And Paul says, it is to be driven by what God has. See, the beauty of the gospel is not that you have a better experience. The beauty of the gospel is that all of your experiences, good, bad, ugly, successful, and unsuccessful, look at me, they have one purpose, is for you to be driven by towels, not by badges, by a life of service. And this is why he basically says, all of this is going to be to each a measure of faith. This is where we simply bring the conversation into the experience that the grace of God is not simply Romans 1 through 11, which is salvation. The grace of God is that this grace was given to me, the purpose why I'm saved, so that I can speak to everyone in the church. Again, based on the towels, because you continue to be driven by badges. You continue to complain. You continue to be unsatisfied. You continue to simply put someone else's responsibility for what you've done, or whatever the case might be. Look at this. And then it says, you got to do this to each a measure. God has given, God has modeled, God has imputed that the one who knew no sin for our sake, Philippians chapter 2, that he was in a condition of God, being God himself, chapter 2 of Philippians, that he detached from that something to be grasped. And then what he does, Jesus is speaking, Paul describing Jesus, that he goes into this process of humility, that he not only became one of us, Emmanuel, God with us, that he not only walked among us, not simply as a rabbi teaching about God, but he was God teaching to us. Not only that he came into the place where now, going back to the confession of Peter, that he is Christ, the Son of the living God, and then he goes through the suffering, he goes through the execution, he goes through the incarceration, he goes through the resurrection, because ultimately what he did from a generation 2,000 years ago that was driven by their ethnicity, a generation that was driven by their knowledge, a generation that was driven by their experience, Jesus imputed, Jesus transferred, Jesus rebuilt, recreated his own character in the life of the church. So when Paul says that this is to each a measure of faith, the beauty of this gospel is that this morning we understand that this faith, literally this faith, is a forensic faith. This is not a group of people that simply grew up believing in God. This is not about how you were raised. I am glad that mama and grandmama and the previous whoever, you know, helped you and navigated those things, but those were means to an end. Your faith, important as it is, has no meaning unless you have God as the object of that faith. This is why the faith has to be forensic. It's a faith of somebody else given to you. This is why if you keep on thinking that this is your faith, this is why you're struggling. This is why you keep on basing your decisions on what you feel and what you see and what you hear and what you taste and what you touch and what you, anybody try, you dream by your senses. See, we begin the conversation understanding that this experience of salvation is the forensic faith, the forensic faithfulness, the forensic ability to trust God in the context of brokenness given to us by Jesus Christ. That implies that the Bible, for the next few Sundays, is going to speak of gifts and fruits of the Spirit. But the context is not the giftedness of your life, and it's not how you go about it. See, those are forensic gifts given by a forensic agent. His name is Jesus, and this is literally the manifestations, which is the mind of Jesus in the context of a broken government, the mind of Jesus in the context of a broken family, the mind of Jesus in the context of a broken body that potentially COVID has affected. This is the behavior of Jesus manifested in the context of a generation that understands that the gospel of Jesus Christ is the behavior of Jesus, is the mind of Jesus, exclusively experienced in the context of community, in the context of how God not only determines those who will be saved, but he also determines the reason why we are saved.